Well, I'm in Paris at Gare du Nord. It's Friday morning, the 2nd of May. And yes, dear Dutch listeners, from now on, this podcast will be in English. After 6 years of talking to all the key players in the Dutch energy transition, it's time for a change. A big change. Starting today, I'm in search of Europe's energy future. And of course, I hope that you will join me in this new big adventure. I'll be traveling the continent, looking at how Europe's energy system is taking shape. After the loss of most of Russia's natural gas. After the start of the first truly worldwide energy crisis. And with energy prices in Europe much higher than in the US and China. I'll be looking for answers. How will Europe be able to balance security of supply, affordability and sustainability? Is Brussels going to be able to hold its own now geopolitical storms are raging? And where is Europe's energy-intensive industry heading? And what about the raw materials we so desperately need in order to move away from fossil fuels? I'm going to put these and other questions to the head of an organization that was established in the aftermath of the 1973 oil crisis. In the last 50 years, this international agency has grown to be one of the most authoritative voices in the world of energy. In search of Europe's energy future, my guest today is the executive director of the International Energy Agency, Dr. Fatih Birol.
Very well organized, and I traveled again a lot this year in Brazil, in India, in Japan, different parts of the world, but I didn't miss one single match, including the friendly matches of my football team, Galatasaray.
In the stadium?
No, I watch it. I watch it in my telephone or in the iPad, but sometimes in the stadium as well, of course.
Okay, Dr. Birol, a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to talk to you because, well, if you start a journey in search of Europe's energy future, I mean, where better to start than here in Paris, very near the Eiffel Tower, well, talking to the man, who knows everything. You know everything about the European energy system, wouldn't you agree?
I would say I know a lot of things and a few opinions about Europe's energy future, but also Europe's energy past as well.
Yes. You were a guest on the podcast in 2019. For that interview, we met in The Hague.
Yes.
You were presenting the latest edition of the World Energy Outlook.
Yes, sir.
Well, since then, we've had the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
A war broke out in Europe. We have had the first truly worldwide energy crisis, as the IEA calls it.
Yeah.
Looking back on the past, 2-3 years, if I were to ask you about a specific moment that is most striking to you, as the IEA's executive director, what would it be?
So I would say perhaps the most striking one was for me 24th of February when the world woke up to the news that Russia invaded Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in fact, it was a big surprise to many. But to be honest with you, not a big surprise to IEA, because months before that, when we look at the Russian gas exports to Europe, there was a significant decline. And I remember that I gave an interview to Financial Times, and I used an expression along the lines that a significant decline in the exports of natural gas to Europe may also be a signal for the growing tensions between Russia and Europe. Something along those lines. I normally don't make any geopolitical comments, but I couldn't hide it. And I know that after the war broke, NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg, in a press conference with Bundeskanzler Scholz, he acknowledged that the IEA has seen it, because I told him, Stoltenberg. So 24th of February was a watershed moment for me. But another moment, just 1 week after, because what happened is that it meant that the Europe was entering an energy crisis, because a big chunk of our natural gas and oil was coming from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It meant the start of an energy crisis. I brought my colleagues together. On 24th of February, I was in Brussels just giving a speech there. When I came back to office, I brought my colleagues that afternoon together. And we said, let's move. And I asked them to that we come together and to make a 10-point plan.
Yes.
How Europe can address this issue without keeping the lights on. Economy is not destroyed, and cutting the Russian energy imports, but at the same time being in line with our climate targets.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with 10-point plan. This was 1st of March, and then I had a press conference with the President Ursula von der Leyen to share
this February, and she I have to quote here. She said, "The bloc had made it through those winters first and foremost thanks to you, Fatih Birol."
Yes, she's a very kind, president. But we work very hard to support Europe there.
Okay, we'll get back to why we were in a crisis, or are we still? Is Europe still in an energy crisis?
We have still major bruises, and mm-hmm. especially on the economic side. But in Europe, we lack criticizing our policymakers, our governments. But sometimes we should also congratulate them when they really deserve it. I believe European governments act in solidarity to respond to the crisis, and we went through this crisis without freezing, and without our economies being very badly affected. Having said that, many bruises on the economic side. Maybe we can discuss.
Well, I
later.
Would like to start with them. Yes,
of course.
Please, because we have quite high energy prices, higher than in the United States and China, about twofold, threefold, fourfold, depends on electricity or gas.
Natural gas and electricity, both of them. Yes.
Yes. Energy dependency in the EU has gone up in the last 30 years. We're now at about 63% dependent on import.
Yeah.
Our heavy industries are having a tough time.
Yeah.
Deindustrialization is the word.
Yeah.
In the Netherlands, it's heard a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Companies scaling back,
mm-hmm.
moving perhaps to the United States
mm-hmm.
with the IRA, the
mm-hmm.
subsidy scheme, so to say. So if we look at the energy situation at the moment in Europe, what are your thoughts? The bruises, again.
Exactly, bruises. I think we are, in Europe, we are facing a major challenge whether Europe will remain an important, significant economic power and as such political power in the world or not. So this is, we have to make a decision, and for this, in my view, Europe needs to come with a new industry master plan.
We'll get to the end of the talk. We're going to speak about this.
Okay.
But can I interrupt you? Sorry.
Of course.
Because you said a bruise.
Yeah.
But if you say this, it sounds a bit more than a bruise. It sounds like maybe an arm and a leg is falling off.
But this is the reasons of this big challenge I mentioned to you, not only as a result of the Russia's invasion of Ukraine or over-reliance of Russia, it is some historical roots in my view. In my view, Europe made three monumental historic mistakes in terms of energy.
I thought you used to say two. there's another
no,
one.
No, three.
Yeah, three.
No, it's three.
Okay.
So depending on what you look at it, number one is the over-reliance on one single country for energy imports. This is Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong anyways to whatever the country is, even the most innocent country in the world, you don't rely on one single country, one single trade route, one single company.
But at the moment, we're for, I think, about 30% reliant on Norway.
But Norway is only coming from, we get gas from Russia, we got gas, we got oil, we get many, many things. So, and to be honest with you, when I look at the geopolitical picture, Norway and Russia are, I wouldn't put them in the same context. This is number one, over-reliance on Russia. The second one is Europe was getting almost 30% of its electricity from nuclear power 25 years ago, and Europe turned its shoulder back to nuclear power. It is now coming to about 15-16% in the next years to come.
Well, some countries turned.
Total EU.
No, but some countries turned down nuclear. Germany, famous
Germany,
example.
Some of them is Germany, but not only Germany. Some of them shut down, but some of them didn't build new. This is also turning back. This is for example, in France. Mm-hmm. President Macron, who is a big now driver of nuclear power in Europe and in the world, when he took office first time, he said he wants to bring the share of nuclear down in Europe. So
yes,
this is the policies are changing. This is number two. The third one that sometimes people forget is on the clean energy side. Today, by far the number one additions in the new power capacity comes from solar energy. Mm-hmm. And 85% of the solar panels are manufactured in China.
China, yes.
But 25 years ago, or maybe 22 years ago, the solar the journey started in Europe. It was Germany, Spain, Italy put a lot of subsidies. But after a while, they dropped the ball. And China took it over. Mm-hmm. So developing a clean energy technology is something like running a marathon. A marathon is 42 kilometers. And you get the gold medal only and only if you finish the 42 kilometers first. Europe finished the first 10 kilometers first, didn't get anything. Nobody remembers who finishes a marathon the first 10 kilometers, and China took it over. So therefore, I think it was a big mistake not to have a consistent and strategic position and to push the solar or clean energy technologies there. And these three strategic, in my view, monumental mistakes, over-reliance on Russia, turning back to nuclear power, and not to continue to push the solar manufacturing, ended up our energy situation, which has been now aggravated with the Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Yes. You took office as the executive director in 2015.
That's right.
You've been working here for more than 20 years.
Almost 29 years, yes.
Yes, well, yes. Almost 30 then.
Yes, almost 30 years, yeah.
Was the IEA warning governments when they were making this monumental mistake? Because there has been some criticism of the IEA as well the last couple of months.
It is always, of course, we always have criticism, but everything is on black and white, as we say. For example, I have a historic interview with the Financial Times 2004. We can give it to you. And where I am saying that the German government shouldn't be relying on Gazprom that much, which could have major implications. It is 2004, which means 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. When it comes to nuclear power, when France said we are going to, French government, reduce the share of nuclear power, I said it is wrong. For me, nuclear power in France is as important as the Arc de Triomphe in Champs-Élysées. Mm-hmm. It's a national asset of France. They shouldn't do it.
But because you talk to heads of state all the time. I think yesterday there was the Japanese prime minister here.
That's right.
I'm very honored to follow after him.
It's a great pleasure. It's a great pleasure. Yeah.
No, but what, I mean, you're not going to tell me what the Bundeskanzler said to you personally, of course, but what was the reaction of the French government and the German government when you gave these, well, sort of, remarks.
Yeah. So sometimes they agree, sometimes they listen. For example, I give you one example from your neighbor, Belgium. After the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, at that moment, Belgium government's position was to shut down nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. I talked with De Croo, the prime minister,
yes,
and with the energy minister, long discussions, and they have agreed to extend the lifetime. And Prime Minister De Croo publicly acknowledged the IAEA's role here, that because there was a coalition in Belgium.
Sure.
It is not easy to take some decisions sometimes.
Because there's still the Prime Minister is in favor of more nuclear, and I think the Energy Prime Minister isn't.
I think Prime Minister and the government took the decision to extend the lifetime, and they want to build new nuclear power plants there. So we are very open, and we are very happy to say what we think.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very happy to see that the several government leaders, mm-hmm, and industry leaders are coming to IAEA to ask for advice, whether or not they implement this advice or not. But we see most of the time it is useful for them. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't ask our advice so often.
But like I said, I mentioned the criticism of the IAEA a bit recent. You got a letter, a personal letter, I think, from White House. No, sorry.
Not the White House.
No, a former White House advisor made some comments, but you also got a letter from the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural
Resources. But it's the same. So what
resources. How do you? They say that you sort of neglected your main task to make sure and to advise on security of supply.
Energy security, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why do you think this criticism is now? Because, as you said, you have been warning as IAEA, you have been talking to heads of state. Why do you think?
So I think this is, first of all, I should say that we got such letters all the time. We look at them, we take them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, I already sent an answer to them.
It's quite a lot of questions, eh?
Lots of questions. I love questions, but I even like more the answers what I give them. So what we said is that two things. One of them is IAEA takes energy security as a core mission. And I gave some examples. One of them is I just mentioned the 10-point plan. It was the most important energy security challenge of the last 10 years, maybe. Second, we have also made two release of oil stocks to make comfort the market.
Mm-hmm.
And third, we are also not only the existing energy security challenges, but the looming ones, such as critical minerals. We were the first one to allude to them. This is one issue I am hopeful that they are convinced on that. But I have to tell you something. Energy security and climate change, these are both of the issues we focus and we will focus. And I categorically reject to choose one over another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a young boy in Ankara, I was annoyed by a question that I got from the elderly people. Said, "Do you love your mother or father more?" So, I mean, I cannot make a choice between them. Why should I make a choice between them? I love my mother and I love my father.
It's quite a strange question.
Very strange question. You never get it in the Netherlands, this question.
No. So well, not me personally. No, so.
I got this question. I don't know if the others...
There's somebody at the table nodding. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. It's other parts of the world as well. Netherlands is the exception, as it is always the case. So, we are going to address energy security and climate change at the same time. And this is something we are going to do. Yeah.
Can it perhaps be that, because I read your reports, they're
thank
always
you
excellent.
Much. Thank you very much.
Yes. Maybe it has to do, I'm just trying out, to about the press statements, which have been focusing, perhaps it's a question to you, a bit more on climate change than on energy security. Is that perhaps where this criticism is coming from?
I don't know. I don't want to talk about that criticism particularly, but some of the criticism might be really trying to address one issue. Yes. Some criticism may have some political background behind that as well. Of course, I don't know what was the case in this one, but we are very clear that both energy security and climate change are as urgent as each other, and we will address both of them.
How should Europe be moving forward? That's the question, of course. You said Europe needs a new industrial master plan. You said it at the start of the interview.
Yeah, yeah.
What should the master plan entail?
You know, I don't take a lot of holidays, only once a year, and as my colleagues know and complain, because if I don't take holidays, it is not easy for them to take holidays, but I tell them go for holidays. But when I go for holidays, I always come up with an op-ed. And this is the op-ed I published in Financial Times, I think, some 2 years ago, or 1.5 years ago. The reason is the following. Europe has a major cost disadvantage, first of all, vis-a-vis energy cost disadvantage, vis-a-vis China and United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, Europe is behind China and also slowly but surely United States in the clean energy manufacturing. So, in Europe, we have two big jobs. If we want to stay an important economic power in the next years to come, first one is how our existing industries, today's industries, such as iron, steel, petrochemical, I don't know, cement, and the others, despite the cost disadvantage,
mm-hmm.
can survive, and how we bridge this cost gap, and should we, in fact, try to keep all of them alive, or should we really let some of them go? This is the one first question. The second question is, tomorrow's industry, namely electric cars, batteries, electrolyzers, heat pumps, solar panels, today, on average, 75% are manufactured in China. And United States, with the Inflation Reduction Act, is coming quickly.
Mm-hmm.
How Europe, what kind of role European industry will have in tomorrow's clean energy manufacturing? So today's industry, how to survive, which one to survive, and tomorrow, which of the clean manufacturing we have chances as Europe, because we can't compete in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
We have to analyze them, which supply chains where we can have a good chance to compete with the others,
yes.
with the US, with China, with Middle East, with India. So therefore, Europe needs, in my view, to bring these things together and needs a new industry master plan. And it's an industry plan, but it has to have the components of energy, trade, what kind of trade policy should be there, economic and labor components. In my view, this is the number one issue of the new commission
mm-hmm.
in Brussels coming to power. In my view, this is the first homework. Last week, the former prime minister of Italy, Mr. Draghi, was here, and it is what I told him. For me, and I told also the Mrs. von der Leyen, the number one issue is how European industry will be competitive in the future. How? Because this is our economic power. This is where the employment is. Because if we are not, Europe is not successful here, which it means that there will be implications on the employment.
Mm-hmm.
And this in turn would mean you provide a fertile ground for the populistic people, the extreme corners of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. and which is not good news, I believe.
I'm just telling the listeners, Dr. Birol is hitting the microphone a bit. You don't have a headset, you don't hear it, but people are hearing it. So if you tap on that, people hear it.
Ah, okay.
So it's okay. Just to explain.
Okay, perfect.
Back to the subject. Oh, but I think the energy crisis costs has cost the EU about 1,000 billion euros, all in all, with all the subsidy schemes and guaranteeing low energy price, 1,000 billion euros. I mean, you raised two very important questions: existing industry, how to go about them, keep them or not, new industries. But do you see any answers already being formulated in the state's capitals?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on this. I wouldn't say that the views of the capitals are exactly in line with each other. So it is the reason I believe there needs to be a united European response to that. One of the reasons why Europe is not anymore at danger as a result of the energy crisis started 2 years ago is because Europe act in solidarity. So mm-hmm. This is what Europe needs. Come together. We have a big advantage of being a single market, making use of this. But the capitals, all the capitals, at least almost all of them, should have the same view in this new industrial master plan. This is, in my view, the most important challenge in front of Europe.
I would like to put you one final quote from Mr. Dan Jurgensen, the Danish climate and development minister. I think he's... is his function. He said, well, on this topic, he said, we have to, we have to keep the competitiveness. It doesn't hurt the competitiveness. So we have to be competitive as Europe. Does not hurt employment. It does not lead to more inequality. So all the new policies have to be strengthening competitiveness and employment, etc. When I read this, I thought, isn't this a bit late? Shouldn't we have had this talk in European capitals before Fit for 55 and before we started this? Because we have the elections in June coming up. There's a right-wing sort of, well, surge expected. Isn't it a bit late?
I completely agree. It is a bit late. A bit late to have the competitiveness issue put on the table and try to address it at a European level. But once again, as I said, we are facing this situation for two reasons. One, these three monumental historic mistakes we did, plus linked to that, the Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It is late, but better than never. But I cannot guarantee you that the new commission will be able to come with the right industry master plan. And this is, but in my view, it's a make or break for Europe, because if we don't have a strong industry sector in Europe, it will have a lot of impact on our economy, employment, and at the same time on the political weight of Europe in the world.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot to look forward to and to hope, make or break, you say.
Right.
I'll be in search of Europe's energy future. Where should I go?
I think you should, if I were you, I would talk not only people like me who deal with the energy issues on a daily basis, but other part of the equation. I would talk with the trade unions, with the labor. So I have recently, in fact, only last week, we brought many trade unions, the labor, what they think about the clean energy transition, how we can have clean energy policies without having a disproportionate burden on the labor and mid-income people. This is key for me. And it is the reason we are coming very soon with a strategic proposal to Europe and other countries, what kind of additional policies, in addition to the clean energy policies, needed in order to make it affordable for the low and mid-income people. So my suggestion to you would be, after talking people like me who deal with energy on a daily basis, or the companies and the others, it may not be a better idea to talk about the labor and the people who are who have low and mid-income groups.
Okay, thank you very much. Final question, of course, you always want to put in Galatasaray in all your interviews. They
yes,
tell me
yes, yes.
We did it last time. Oh, you smile now.
Yes,
you,
this is the best question. Yes,
yes, you're a lifetime honorary member.
Yes, exactly.
I even read that you put the Galatasaray Football Club colors in your reports. Is that true?
It is, in fact, the IEA has one major report called World Energy Outlook.
Yes.
And I became the head of the division that produced this report in 1998. Until that moment, that book was the colors of blue and yellow. And since that day, I changed the colors, it's red and yellow, the colors of my football team. But when I do what I do now, when I visit other countries, I give the Galatasaray T-shirt to them. And President Lula gave me a very nice T-shirt of the Brazilian football team. So I exchange T-shirts of the different football teams, and I give Galatasaray T-shirt with great honor to other friends and colleagues.
Okay, well, the big match, 19th of May against Fenerbahce.
Yes.
Will you be there in the stadium?
I really hope so. I really hope so. But in any case, I will watch it, and I am already very nervous for this match.
Dr. Fatih Birol, Executive Director of the International Energy Agency, thank you very much for this interview. And of course, I would also like to thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in once again. My name is Remco de Boer. I hope you'll join me again next time in Search of Europe's Energy Future.